This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We air on Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to your smartphone and look up State of the Union on your podcast app. We can be followed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. If you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at State of the Union, that's one word, at dc37.net. Tonight, we've got a couple of interesting folks, and we're going to begin with New York Times, former New York Times reporter Stephen Greenhouse, who is the author of The Big Squeeze and has another book coming out this summer called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Welcome to the show, Stephen Greenhouse.
Nice to be here, Chris.
This has been, we talk on this program often about the President of the United States, the presidency, where we are. And it's important, I think, to talk about policy because so much of the noise is around style and tweets. But there is work being done that is, we believe, the union believes, is harmful to American workers. What is your assessment of where we are in the first 2 years under Donald Trump in terms of the status of working people?
So Trump ran, especially in the Midwest, as the best friend of workers, especially blue collar workers. He was going to get tough with China and Mexico and immigrants. And one thought, well, maybe after he's inaugurated, he would really go to bat for workers. And in many policies, he's really adopted anti-worker and anti-union stances. The Obama administration extended overtime pay to additional 5, 6, 7 million workers. Trump's rolling that back. The Obama administration said, when Wall Street firms handle workers, retirees, 401k funds, they have to, do it with fiduciary duty, put the workers' interest first, not the investment firms first. And Trump has rolled that back. Trump has named judges and folks on the NLRB who are really pretty aggressive about unionizing. So as many of your listeners know, of course, the Janus decision was a major blow to public sector unions. It will probably cause them to lose many members, and it will be a real hit to their treasuries. So the deciding vote in that case was Trump's appointee Neil Gorsuch. And if Trump had really named a union-friendly person to the court, Janus would have come out a different way. I imagine if Merrick Garland were on the court rather than Neil Gorsuch, we wouldn't have seen a decision that was so bad to public sector unions. There was another big case where Gorsuch also delivered the deciding vote called Epic Systems, which was a case where companies tried to bar employees from bringing class action lawsuits. And workers said, we should, the company said you have to go to arbitration. You can't bring class action lawsuits. And people said, the workers argue that under the National Labor Relations Act, workers should have the right ability to bring collective action, including class actions. And again, by 5-4, the Supreme Court, with Gorsuch, delivering the pivotal vote, really delivered a very, very anti-worker decision. Now, there are some areas where Trump has sort of helped workers. The unemployment rate's down to 3.7%. That's very good. Job growth has been quite good. Really not much better than Obama's last 18 months, but it's been quite good. And, the tightening labor market, in theory, should be raising wages. But so-called nominal wages have been stuck around 2.8, 2.9%. They haven't been increasing as the unemployment rate has gone down. And also, there's been a spurt in inflation recently, so that over the past year, for a typical American worker, their wages have, their after inflation wages have just gone up 0.1%. And, you know, that's no fun because, you know, the stock market has generally been hitting records. You know, yesterday was a bad day for the stock market. Corporate profits have been hitting record levels, but wages are really going nowhere. And, you know, Trump really isn't doing anything to increase wages. And, you know, he works very hard to goose the economy, stimulate the economy by, you know, removing regulations. And the Republicans say that's great, that's stimulating the economy, that's letting entrepreneurs rip. But, you know, many of these regulations that are, you know, being removed or rolled back help workers, help the environment, you know, help make sure that, you know, people live in communities and neighborhoods where their kids are safe from pesticides.
He's trying. The best I can get out of this is that he believes that he can hurt unions and put forth a rhetoric that life is better for workers. And that is a challenge to get around. But that's the Republican mantra these days in terms of, you know, people are employed. Underemployment is a topic of discussion, but not really. Underemployment being the fact that you have to work two jobs to make the money that you folks were making 20 or 30 years ago. Is this just what we have to look forward to for the next at least four, six years?
So, many people hope, Chris, that, you know, if the unemployment rate remains low, finally, wages will start going up. You know, Trump, it's interesting. A lot of states have adopted $13, $14, 15-hour minimum wage, so a lot of people on the bottom are getting wage increases.
Right.
Because of Fight for 15 and Governor Cuomo and Jerry Brown and Washington State. But, you know,
all those Republicans.
Yeah, no thanks to Donald Trump or Republicans.
Right.
And, you know, if Trump and Republicans really want to help lift wages, they can, you know, increase the minimum wage, but they're allergic to that idea. I see that the chairman of the House Labor Committee thinks that the minimum wage should not exist. So the other thing where Trump, you know, arguably is helping workers, and it's a real mess, is on tariffs and trade.
And, well, before we go there, let me just point out that the federal minimum wage has not changed. This is a state-by-state
move
you're seeing, and that's dependent upon the governors in the state and the legislatures of the state getting their acts together and saying we're going to do this. But on the federal level, there has been no change in the minimum wage.
Yeah, it's been stuck at $7.25 an hour for about a decade.
All right. I'm sorry.
And whenever I talk to some people and say, they'll ask me, what's the minimum wage? And I say, $7.25. They say, really? That's ridiculous.
Right. And they confuse that with the Fight for 15. But so I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's this idea that the economy is doing well, although it's, as you say, the market has done poorly this week and took a huge crash. But it's this idea that people are living better than they had been 2 years ago that is not really backed up by fact.
But I mean, you know, so, you know, after inflation, wages are not increasing. You know, some people are living better because a higher percentage of workers are working, more people per household are working, and that will, you know, that maybe they're working more hours. That will increase, you know, household income a bit. But, you know, after inflation, wages are really not going up. And that's a big mystery why, when the unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in like 50 years,
right,
wages aren't going up. And there are a lot of theories, you know, that unions are weak, you know, pressure from trade, you know, there aren't as many, you know, there are all these oligopolies, you know, in a town there'll only be like two hospital systems and, you know, so you used to be able to like apply to 10 or 15 different hospitals and maybe get a nice raise that way. But if they're just two hospital systems and they're kind of colluding on pay, it's very hard to get a raise. And, you know, so Trump is very good at, you know, dominating the conversation and making the nation focus on what he wants. So, you know, so now a lot of attention isn't paid to trade. And, you know, he's done two major things on trade, three. So he imposed these 25% tariffs on steel, which have greatly increased profits for the steel industry. But, you know, 30,000 members of the United Steelworkers are pissed off that, you know, profits for the steel industry going up, and they feel that the contract being offered them is peanuts. And they feel, well, these tariffs have really been great for the companies, for the industry, but they're really not helping us. And then, you know, there'll be a debate forever about whether the tariffs are helping the American economy, American workers, more than they're hurting. I mean, you know, a lot has been written about this nail factory in Missouri that relies on steel imports. And, you know, it's had to, like, shut, you know, lay off half its people because, the tariff on steel from Mexico, I think, this has been so bad for it. So they've had to lay off a lot of workers. So on one hand, some regular steel mills have fired up and are operating again, whereas some companies that rely on steel, that buy steel, you know, have laid off people. So, you know, there'll be a big debate about whether the tariffs are net-net helping workers or not, but certainly helping the steel industry and the aluminum industry. Then the other thing is NAFTA. And I've been trying to figure out, Trump, you know, forever said NAFTA is the worst trade agreement in history and it cost millions of jobs. It didn't cost millions of jobs. It cost some jobs. But the way I read it is that NAFTA doesn't include any many major changes. You know, the new United States-Mexico-Canada trade accord doesn't include many huge changes that will be make a huge difference for American workers and American manufacturing. There was a rule, domestic content, that for cars from Mexico to come in tariff-free to the United States, 5/8, 62.5% of the value added had to be done in North America. So they've increased that to 75%. So like another eighth from 5/8 to 3/4. That's nice. I'm all for it. But it's not going to cause huge changes. And then the new NAFTA has gotten a lot of nice attention from unions because they say that, you know, a certain amount of the work has to be done by workers making, I think 40% has to be done by workers making at least $16 an hour. And that sounds great. But let's face it, a lot of companies in Mexico are not going to pay their workers $16 an hour. So they might opt out of paying people $16 an hour, and that means they might just have to pay a small tariff instead. There'll be small tariffs instead when they ship cars from Mexico to the U.S.
It sounds like a mixed bag at best.
Yeah, it is. It's not like, you know, there are like three Grand Slam home runs in the accord that are vastly changing things and making them much better for American workers. You know, Trump will say this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it's, you know, on the margins it's somewhat better. And, you know, maybe some friends in labor will say I'm wrong, that it really does more for workers than I realize. And another big thing, so
we've got about a minute left, bro.
Okay, so another big thing is, so the new Mexico-Canada trade agreement has so much stronger language about worker rights, and that's great. But the AFL-CIO, the steelworkers, the Teamsters are pissed off that it hasn't strengthened the enforcement mechanisms at all. So, like, and that was one of the big problems with NAFTA. You know, there's nice language about worker rights, but the enforcement mechanism was a joke. And, and the steelworkers and the AFL-CIO are saying, we don't know if we're going to support NAFTA unless, or this new agreement, unless there's real enforcement mechanisms and language.
Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times reporter, the author of a book that's called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. We didn't talk enough about public employees on this.
Oh, right. I should have.
Well, we will do that at another time, my friend. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dick.
Take care. At a press conference last month, Mayor de Blasio was joined by New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer, DC 37 Executive Director and New York City Employee Retirement System Trustee Henry Garrido, and others to announce a new goal to double the investments of the New York City pension funds in climate change solutions to $4 billion by 2021. Henry Garrido will be joining us by phone to discuss the plan, but first we have a few words from Mayor de Blasio and Director Garrido delivered at the press conference.
Sandy left an extraordinarily negative impact on this city. We lost 44 lives because of Sandy. We lost $19 billion worth of property. The impact was $19 billion on our city. This is one storm. And we're having this discussion on the day when, as you said, the Carolinas are facing something that could be as bad or worse. There is an actual dollar figure that has been estimated as what we need globally to finally create the kind of sustainable energy, renewable energy, that would allow us to save this earth. As simple as that, to have energy sources that would no longer poison us and kill us, but would actually allow us to live. That dollar figure, that estimate is $1 trillion per year. And that is something that will be needed over the course of the next few decades, all the way up to 2050, when we have the goal, all of us, of reducing emissions by 80%. $1 trillion a year might sound unreachable, but when you actually look at it, it's the kind of goal that can be attained if we are bold enough. And we, as New Yorkers, have to be the boldest. We have to lead the way. We have to show others it can be done. We, as of today, are announcing that we will be the first American city to commit 2% of our pension funds to investments in climate solutions. Henry Garrido, as executive director of DC 37, and I've had this conversation with him over years, is keenly aware of our obligation to our retirees, and he is a very substantive guy who focuses on the numbers, but also understands that we have to think about our investments differently than ever before because we're facing a crisis. My pleasure to introduce Henry Garrido.
Climate change is not only real, but as trustees, we did the responsible analysis. We look at what a 1% global warming means, what a 2% global warming means, what it would mean to the investments, to the money that we're putting on there. And what we discovered was that it was not a good economic-sounding investment.
Now on the line is Executive Director and NYSERS trustee Henry Garrido. Sir, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
You made the NYSERS decision to move investments, a part of the investment portfolio, to clean energy. And it's a small portion. It's not a large portion of the portfolio. That has generated applause by some, and others are criticizing the move. Let's talk about that. What was the underlying philosophy to do this, and what is your take on why this is good for the pensions and for the future?
Yeah, so first let me clarify something. This was not just from the perspective of the NYSERS or the New York City retirement system. OFA and pension retirement system are investing on this. So we represent people in the Board of a Retirement System, for instance, and we have a trustee there who supports this, as well as the teacher's retirement system, where we have members. But both police and fire all committed to the same idea. And the concept is that we are going to take some of the money that has now been divested from the fossil fuel industry and attempt to redouble the funding for renewable energy. And there, when you started, you talked about how there are those who are in support of it and those who have criticized the move. The reality is the only criticism of this move has come from the fossil fuel industry, who has repeatedly hired guns in public relations firms to try to create state tactics among the people that would represent them on the general public, saying that this is a hasty move and that we haven't thought out the investment. And nothing could be further from the truth. This was a well-analyzed, well-thought-out process in which we engaged several consultant firms who advised us as to where the pension investment is, how well or how poorly we've done. And we've done very poorly in some of the investments regarding fossil fuels. So this is, first from the fiduciary responsibility, a great move for the pensioners, because we're looking at the future and we're looking to invest a growing industry who is actually producing good dividends for the pensioners, but at the same time, we're doing a good thing with the environment.
And, you know, the New York Times came out with a piece this week that said the first crisis, environmental crisis, we're going to see around 2040. I mean, it was a major piece. It was talking about how desperate this situation has become, that there will be an environmental crisis by the year 2040, which, by my reckoning, is 22 years away. So this is a very responsible thing in terms of for the world and for my kids and for your kids, correct?
Yeah, indeed. And I think that some of us here, the union, remember recent memory where Hurricane Sandy hit and we had water that went all the way up to the second floor of the 125 Barclay Street site. That has been unheard of, but that is something that we are not anticipating, hoping that it will never happen again, but understand that because of what is happening, it is likely to happen unless we change course. And I think that we're doing the responsible thing, both from the perspective of what we do in terms of the rate of return, but also what we're doing in reinvesting with good-paying new jobs into an industry that's growing. I have to say that, unfortunately, here in the New York, we are way behind maybe a couple of decades of the changes that have been made in other industrialized countries. I recently had the opportunity to travel to Denmark, where 45% of their energy is from wind, offshore wind, and it's, you know, a sector that is producing cheaper electricity by almost 50% and creating good-paying jobs. And I think that it is time. I mean, I think the state has beginning to turn around. We now have an RFP out that was issued by the NYSERDA, which is the agency that regulates this, asking for 850 megawatt wind farm here in New York, whether it is in, you know, Brooklyn, Navy Yard, or Staten Island, or some other place in Coney Island, remains to be seen. But in the meantime, there is that going on. There's already a farm that is going up in Long Island, in the offshore, in the south shore of Long Island. That's happening already. So we could choose to be deniers, as we have, as our president has been,
right,
by denying the science, or we can embrace what we know to be true already, and begin to invest in the future, and begin to also recognize that we only have one planet, and I want my two children, both Leslie and Christopher, to have an opportunity to live in a planet that they're not, that, you know, we're not ruining at the time. So this is a good, you know, thing, a good investment. It's a win-win-win situation. Win because it lowers the cost of energy for the consumer. Win because it's good for the pension and the investment. Win because it creates good-paying jobs in New York for New Yorkers. Good union-paying jobs with benefits and pensions and whatnot. And it allows us to recruit people in manufacturing in places that the United States haven't done. So it's good for the consumer, good for the taxpayers, good for the workers, good for the pension investments. So to me, this is a no-brainer. But, you know, these scare tactics are done by people who have made a tremendous amount of money. And, of course,
right, and
they're
going to
be
business.
Addicting to it.
And they're going to be relentless about it, you know, right? Just as they're relentless. Just as the anti-union folks have been relentless about trying to get Janus through and trying to get folks to leave unions, they're going to be relentless about trying to preserve the status quo.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this is truly, as cheesy as it may sound, is that it's the proverbial battle of the haves and the have-nots. And they're trying to confuse folks to say, oh, well, they're risking this, or this is some sort of liberal policy that, you know, is being pursued by the union for philosophical view. There is no philosophical view. You can look at the science. It's incredible that every year, from one year to the next, we break the record on temperature in our planet and here in the United States. And every year we see the consequences of flooding, hurricanes in New Orleans, and, you know, in Florida, in Texas, in places we've never seen before. In Puerto Rico, for instance, huge flooding still creating devastating damage for the island. And we could, you know, we could be deniers of that, or we can say, are we being responsible with $195 billion we're investing in our from our pensions, or are we looking at where is the changing of the tie,
right.
pardon the pun, but where is the right. tie being changed here, and are we going to be ahead of it as we have in the past? The pension system, by the way, are doing well. I mean, we are exceeding for the last 2 years the rate of expectations, and I'm proud to have worked with the controller and the mayor to divest some very bad things that included hedge funds and private prisons. And in spite of all of that, or in addition to that, we're doing well. And so we've lowered the fees to historic lows into the pension system, which hasn't happened. So we have done the responsible thing, and we'll continue to do the responsible thing about this.
DC 37 members can read more on Henry Garrido's take on this in the Public Employee Press. You've got your column this month is dedicated to the issue of the pensions and clean energy. You pointed out that wealthy people all over the world already know that clean, sustainable energy is the way to go. The chief financial officer of UBS Global Wealth Management points out that 39% of wealthy investors already have sustainable investments in their portfolio. And he goes on to say a great deal of evidence supports the conclusion that sustainable investors can at least match the returns of ordinary investors. So you're making the case there that that this is a good investment, and that the scare tactics of the folks that you mentioned before, a well-financed PR machine, should not exploit the fears of pensioners.
Indeed. And I think that one should remember that the very same funders of the Janus case, the Koch brothers, are heavily invested in the fossil fuel industry.
Right, right.
And so then it's all part of the same system. As long as they can continue to make unquestionable record-breaking profits over the backs of working people, then, you know, for them, the system works. For them, they want to preserve the status quo. For them, they want to live in 20 years where they are. For us, for working people that are struggling, that, by the way, get a bill every month, and they do this change, and they see, and they pay for the electricity continue to go up, and they pay for the energy going up. That's not good for that. And for workers who are being laid off and displaced, and in many instances getting sick for the coal and the other industry, it's a challenge. And we're not doing this, you know, right away. I mean, it takes time. We're not saying we're going to divest. It's not pulling a plug, you know. But it is true that we are got to do the responsible thing, and we got to lay the groundwork for us to continue to go in the right direction.
Henry Garrido is the executive director of District Council 37 and NYSA's trustee. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for having us.
That's all the time we have for you this evening. Any comments you have about today or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Till next time, ciao.